Welcome to the Manga Revolution podcast. You're home for the best in-depth commentary on the latest manga and anime news and chapters. So I'm your host, Kevin, and with me today is Rock. How are you, Rock?
Hey, Kevin. I'm doing great, as always. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's good. It's been a while since we talked, so it's good to be back to record another episode of this podcast. So on today's episode, we are going to be discussing the latest chapter for My Hero Academia, Dragon Ball Super Kaiju number 8. Spy X Family, and the newest creation from Tokyo Ghoul's creator Tsuishida, named Choji X. But before we start that, I just want to quickly touch on a passing that I think affected both of us is Kentaro Miura's passing this about 2 weeks ago. So I just wanted to briefly touch on that, and like since he is such an influential part of the not just this industry, but his work was seen throughout video games, comic books, manga, anime, and everything. So Rock, what is your history with him and with Miura's work?
I've always loved Miura's artwork. He is probably one of my top three favorite manga artists. His style just appeals to me. And anybody, you know, like you, anyone who got into manga and anime in the 1990s, Berserk was, that was a go-to manga back then. That was one of the big daddy mangas over here in the 90s as it was really starting to blow up in America. That was huge. And of course, it was one of the first manga I got into, and I loved it. The art was, you know, as I was trying to bridge from American comics to manga, you know, I thought Miura's art was perfect because it kind of made that bridge from American comics to Japanese manga pretty easy, because he had such phenomenal line work and detail, which, you know, don't get me wrong, I love a lot of other art from different mangas, okay? And I appreciate it for what they bring to the table. Don't get me, so this is absolutely not a criticism, but his style of art was, I guess, more tailor-made to someone who'd been reading Marvel and DC comics their entire life.
Yeah, and I that's totally understandable. I know just from personally myself, I was more familiar with the anime growing up than the manga. Yeah. Just because I grew up with just Suncoast Video, and that's how I got all my anime from. So shout out to Suncoast, RIP, if unless you're still around. But
right.
But yeah, so I remember just seeing the cover of a Berserker like VHS, and I was just like, oh, this is awesome. This must be an awesome anime. So I just picked it up. Like, that's basically how I picked up all anime. But yeah, it's just crazy seeing how much his style really influenced the entire, like, video games in general. You see that with Final Fantasy VII, with Cloud Strife, and even like a Devil May Cry, Dark Souls, and just a lot of video games is just,
yeah,
ape his style, like with the giant sword and characters are usually for main characters. It's Berserker, basically.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And then the same thing with anime and manga, and like we see that in comic books too, and like almost every industry he has such influence, and it's kind of like a holy trinity of manga, I would say, is Akira from Otomo, Akira Toriyama's Dragon Ball, and then Berserker is like, yep, the three that you would, I considered like those top three are like basically everything's based off those three. So it was incredibly sad hearing that he passed, especially knowing that he wasn't able to finish Berserker. And then I think he had one more ongoing manga series that he was publishing. So it was very, very sad to see that his passing. So,
well, it was amazing. I saw, Kevin, that Dark Horse, of course, made a statement because they did the Berserk manga, right? It was, believe it or not, someone not named Viz doing a manga title. That was a Dark Horse comic. They came out and said, I didn't know this, but after he passed, they came out and said that Berserk is the best-selling Dark Horse title of all time. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, that's crazy and not too crazy, just because especially seeing how popular just manga is in general. And
right.
And we don't, and here in the United States, even though like we definitely have been getting much more manga, and like when you go to Barnes and Noble and stuff, you see a wall of manga. But it's not surprising that Berserker is like their most popular title, given the popularity, yeah, of manga in general. But also Berserker as like a property, it's like so its influence cannot be understated of yeah. like, and I'm sure like you and I, we probably heard about it. And then that's how a lot of like, especially yep. American readers here, we just hear about something, we pick it up and mm-hmm. that a lot of word of mouth. And I'm honestly not surprised, especially because Dark Horse is mostly licensed, yeah. a lot of licensed stuff and everything. And so it's not too surprising. It would be more surprising if it was like Marvel or DC maybe saying this.
Dark Horse said it sold almost 2 million copies.
Nice.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
That's
impressive. Yeah. That's up there. It's probably like right up there with like Demon Souls and stuff, or not Demon Souls, but I'm sorry. Demon Slayer and stuff like that.
Yeah. I tell you, yeah. I mean, I just started, we said before we started recording, I just started rewatching the anime on Netflix. And I encourage everybody, if you've never seen Berserk, it's on Netflix. Hop on it right now, start watching it. Don't worry that it's, I mean, from the 90s, I get it. That's like super old to a lot of people. I think my sons would look at me like, whoa, that's like, were humans around in the 90s? But but trust me, it is aged. I mean, I'm watching it right now. I'm probably, I don't know, maybe a third of the way into the series right now on my rewatch. And it, Kevin, it's really held up the test of time. I think what helps it hold up as well is that Guts's character design has basically become the archetype for every character design since then. So he still looks good.
He's the proto Cloud Strife.
Bingo. You got it. You got it.
Yeah, it's definitely like everybody should experience it, especially if you're a manga anime fan. If you haven't already watched or read the manga, definitely go out and check it out. Moving on, before we start the chapters, a little bit more happier news for both of us is that Dragon Ball got a new movie got announced for 2022, but they haven't really announced any details. So of the movie outside of that, where it's going to be releasing in 2022. So I just wanted to talk about what do you think or would like to see from the new movie coming out?
This, I am so excited. I'm glad they're doing a movie. I think they had such success with Dragon Ball Super Broly. It did so well for them that I'm kind of actually a little more excited that they're doing a movie before deciding to give us more of the, you know, TV anime series personally, because I think it's honestly, I think Super's a little better suited for the movie format at this point, given how the story's going in the manga. So I love this, and I'm really excited that Toei went out of their way to say, hey, Toriyama this is his baby. He's working with the production team, and he's literally working on everything according to Toei, from story composition to the script, actual script work, to character designs. I mean, he is all in it. I love to see Toriyama with a very, very active hand in the movie. That's good.
Yeah, and it's not too surprising that they're doing this, because I was just reading something that it looks like this 2021 fiscal year is going to be the first year where we see like a dip in the how much Bandai Namco and Toei is earning from Dragon Ball. It's not a big dip. They're still earning more than like One Piece and other major franchises. They're still doing it, but you could start seeing that without the anime around, especially. The popularity in terms of it being in the public eye is starting to wane, and you're starting to see a little bit of dip there. But I think making this movie announcement right around when that was put out to investors that Dragon Ball was starting to dip a little bit. It wasn't that much. It was like 10 million yen or something like that. I forget. So it wasn't too bad, but it was still like, oh yeah, the investors are starting to see a dip. Let's announce a movie. But yeah, it's very good that Akira Toriyama is doing this, and I'm hopeful that they just kind of go with an original story idea instead of picking up like the more or something like that, just because
that's what I was going to ask you, because Toriyama released a statement. He wouldn't talk about really any specifics, obviously. Mm-hmm. Not, but he did say in his statement that fans should be prepared for, his words, extreme and entertaining bouts, which may feature an unexpected character. So Kevin, what do you think? So it sounds like we're not getting anything from that. He's doing something new from separate from the manga, right?
Yeah, it feels like it'll be separate from the manga, especially with the moral character, which is the next villain after the Tournament of Power. It seems like his character, I think it would be best suited for an anime arc. Like that would be the first, where if we get the anime, and that's kind of what I'm expecting from the movie, is that after this movie, we're going to probably see an announcement of a new anime. Like, I don't even think it's going to be called Dragon Ball Super, to be honest. They might change the name just because Dragon Ball Super kind of ended and just wrap that up.
Yep.
And even though the manga is still going on and it's called Dragon Ball Super, they're not really connected to each other. They're kind of their own separate animals. So, I kind of hope that they do something different. And maybe, like, my biggest hope for the new movie is that it's not just Goku and Vegeta again.
Yes.
Because that's what Dragon Ball Super has all been about. And I think the biggest thing that Dragon Ball could do for itself to be better and just more engaging for fans is that it's this next era starts to involve more of the Z Fighters, which we got a little bit of a tease in the Moro saga. Not so much in the current one, but in the current saga. But it's just hopefully bringing Gohan, Krillin, and all others that they have a wealth of characters that they could tap into that they're limiting themselves too much just focusing on Goku and Vegeta.
I totally agree with you, because the Dragon Ball universe, I think, for me at least, one of the draws of this franchise is the amazingly deep roster of characters that it has. So many compelling characters, and for them not to be using them all, it's a shame.
Yeah, and for me, if I had a dream scenario, it would be bring the Namekians back in. Make the movie villain like a Namekian or something, to bring especially Piccolo, who's like, I think, would be the third character in Dragon Ball to be after Goku and Vegeta, even though Gohan is arguably. But I think they've done so much with the Namekians, and they haven't tapped into that since the Frieza saga, really, that I kind of would hope that they would tap that into it and go into more of that whole how the Namekians are touch every corner of the universe. That's kind of what the manga says.
Right. I would love that direction. I'm really excited. Look, they're teasing an unexpected character. That makes me happy.
Yeah.
That makes me think that we're going to get what you and I want, which is not just the Goku Vegeta story, you know?
Yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised if we get one of the other villains from another movie, kind of like Broly was like a movie villain from Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah.
I could see like Janemba or somebody from like that was a movie exclusive, and they actually brought into the main Dragon Ball universe that Akira Toriyama has actually done. So I wouldn't be too surprised about that.
So, I'd be good there.
All right, awesome. Well, let's move on to the chapters for this month. So we'll kick it off with My Hero Academia. So this month, My Hero Academia released their chapters 311 through 314. So For the May events, we kick off with Endeavor, Best Genius, and Hawks taking down one of the League of Villains members. And even though they quickly take down those people, they are met with protesters, and those protesters are against basically Hero Society, and it's showing that there's a lot of animosity against heroes. So Endeavor and Hawks and Best Genius quickly go away instead of confronting the protesters. They kind of drive off so that way, because they know that all For One and the League of Villains are placing so much attention on Izuku Midoriya, and they kind of are starting to realize that by sticking so close to Izuku Midoriya and All Might, that they might be actually leading the League of Villains to them. So they start discussing if we should start putting some distance between ourselves and them, so that way Izuku is not as big a target as he already is. But as that is going on and they're having that discussion, All Might's car is bombed as he is like following Deku, and he's bombed by two villains. Luckily, he is able to survive the bombing because of his extra reinforced car that he calls Hercules. And All Might is ducks out of his car and starts confronting the villains because he is so set on protecting Deku until he lives. So, and he uses that intimidating aura that even though without his powers, the two villains that attack him, they kind of crumble just from his aura. So, but as that is going on at the same time, Deku is confronted by a sniper, and the sniper quickly takes out the car, the phone that he's using to communicate with All Might and the Endeavor and the other heroes. And so without being able to contact All Might, the sniper, who we learn is called Lady Naga, who is a former senior at the safety commission that Hawks works at, and who has a rifle quirk, which allows her to create any sort of bullet with her hair that she could fire through her right arm that basically acts like a sniper gun. And from there, because she is able to fire from a distance of 1.5 miles long or longer. So she has the best range out of anybody, including Snipe, one of Deku's teachers who was said to be the best sniper in Japan. But Snipe said in a TV interview that Lady Nagat is a better sniper than her because of her range and her experience just trumps his completely. So Deku's very much in trouble. So he has to use his first attempts to use his Black Whip and Danger Sense quirks to gain some distance from Lady Nagat. But again, she has such a long range that there's no way that he could get far enough to. And he's hit a couple times by Lady Nagat's bullets. And just luckily, because of his Danger Sense, he is able to barely scrape by with just minor injuries. So he decides that he cannot run away. He can't run away fast enough before he's probably going to get hit in a vital spot. So he tries to close in on Lady Nagat instead, closing in distance by zigzagging between buildings. But what Deku doesn't realize, in attempting to get to Lady Nagat, he just falls into her trap because Lady Nagat actually gained a second quirk from All For One during the prison break, that it was his airwalk ability, which he used against All Might in their final battle. So Lady Nagat is actually able to close the distance on him instead. And because she closed the distance on him, she's able to fire more bullets at him at closer range because she doesn't have to focus on long range attacks anymore. So she's only a couple buildings away from him, and is able to nail Deku in his stomach. So Deku, realizing this, he has to automatically kicks in his smoke screen quirk that he has from one of the other One For All users, and he uses it at max power, which luckily for him makes it so that Lady Nagat can't see him, but also makes it so that he's corners himself because he's not sure where he needs to go. So he only really has one way to leave. Since Deku knows that as soon as he comes out of the smoke screen, he'll be a sitting duck for Lady Nagat's attack, he decides to use one of the third One For All users quirk named Fa Jin, which he has not trained in, and he actually is warned by the third user, hey, you have not trained in this, using my quirk yet. It's going to be very dangerous. But Deku says that, hey, I got to do this. Your quirk is the only one that can help me get out of this situation. So he activates Fa Jin, which turns out to be some sort of kinetic energy that he's able to create clones from, and uses his own costume to create clone distractions. We're using the energy that actually does distract Lady Nagat enough with all these clones that he's able to get the jump on her. But Lady Nagat, using her experience, is quickly able to create more bullets and fire them so that Deku's attack ends up failing. And it's here where Lady Nagat reveals to Deku that she actually used to work for the safety commission, like was said to him by Hawks. But she reveals that she was actually one of the people that was hired by the safety commission to kill villains that were threatening the Hero Society that was being shaped during the vigilante era of the My Hero universe, which you could read in the My Hero Vigilante series. So it was her job to kill any terrorists or villains that would threaten the society that was basically you would see from All Might's era of My Hero Academia. And it got to the point for her that she had so much blood on her hands that she could no longer view herself as a hero. And it just caused her to see everything in black and white and see that the world that was created during All Might's era, she calls a false society, that it was everything is fake, nothing is as it is. So that's where she decides her villainous turn. So hearing all this, Deku fires back and says that he already knows that the world is not black and white. It is actually a gray, but even with a world that is gray, it is their job as a heroes to reach their hands out to the people that help. And he goes in for another attack. But just as Lady Nagat and Deku are about to clash, Deku overhears Overhaul, who was with Lady Nagat this entire time, screaming out that he wants to see his boss. And Deku hears Overhaul's voice, and that's kind of where we end the most recent chapter 314. So a lot happens in this couple chapters. So Rock, what did you think of My Hero Academia's main chapters?
this was a big month for this for this title. I mean, really big. I loved it. I thought these chapters were excellent. I think Lady Nagant, I don't know if I'm pronouncing the name correctly, Kevin, we'll find out when the anime comes out, right? But I'm going to go with that pronunciation for now. I think she's a great character, a really cool design. She looks great. I like her. Her quirk is really neat with the rifle arm. I love the concept of her using her hair to infuse the ammunition to make them, you know, indestructible almost. It's the type of creativity that we've kind of come to expect, honestly, from My Hero Academia. So yeah. I love it. She's a great villain. And like all the characters, that's why this manga is so good. The characters are just so fascinating. You rarely get a boring, predictable, one-dimensional character. Everybody is well faceted, and there's more than what meets the eye. At first you think, she's just a bad guy, you know, hitman type, right? That and then it turns, no, she's got a lot more there. She has a lot more complexity to her character. I love the backstory. I love the backstory as her. She was a hero. I like that she was kind of like internal affairs is, you know, for the superhero world, with a splash of the Minority Report, because she would intercept people before they actually did anything, but they were thinking about it, right? So I like that concept. It's a neat concept, and it makes sense. I mean, you have internal affairs for police departments. Why wouldn't you have some kind of analogous body for a world with superheroes, right? It makes sense. And it also makes complete sense that her character would, based on what she went through, would turn out the way she has. You know, her heel turn makes perfect sense with all that she saw. And it, even though the reader may not agree with her per se, you can at least be sympathetic and understand why she would view the world as being fake and false, and why at least, you know, while All for One might be a villain, at least his world is real. It's real. It's not fake. It's not a sham. And yeah, you know, and he embraces the fact that the world is just gray, not good and bad, not black and white. And so you understand as the reader, you completely understand why she would do this heel turn. It makes complete sense. This is really, again, this manga, they just keep doing it. The character work is just fantastic. While we're getting great action, no doubt, awesome action as always, but weaved into that action, Kevin, is just more fantastic character work. And Lady Nagant gets over with the reader, honestly, within a chapter or two, you bought in completely.
Yeah, she has incredible stash. Like, her design just reminds me a lot, and even her, all this character work that that's done in these chapters just reminds me of Stain a lot. In terms of like, were introduced to this incredible badass villainous character, and then as like we get more and more into the fight, we learn more about him, and this is like, it's very much like Stain's introduction, because like Stain was introduced. He just had a badass design, badass quirk that like he felt unstoppable. Lady Nagant feels the same way, where her quirk is so awesome. Everybody talks her up and like saying that she has incredible range and all this stuff. So, and as each chapter goes along, we not only hear about it, but we see it like through the action. So it's like, so that's exactly how you want a character introduction to be. It's not just about like how people talk about the character, but it's about the action as well. So I think they do a lot of good in terms of just the character, pure character design and arc and everything. It's being handled very well. And what I also liked about Lady Nagant is like her relation to especially Hawks, just because you could kind of see that, especially with Hawks' like most recent mission during the paranormal liberation arc, this is kind of who Hawks could have turned into, because we saw that the safety commission also kind of assigned him a similar role in the villain with the League of Villains, when he was trying to be like friends with Dobby and everybody, and trying to get secret membership in there, and he was doing a lot of shady stuff. And even he says it like during his press conference, that like at the end of the arc, that I have to do shady stuff, I did it, it was my job. And you could hear, like, hearing that and then seeing Lady Nagant, you could be like, that's kind of almost the same path that Hawks was going towards, and this is kind of what he could have became if he didn't have like Endeavor or other heroes in his life to help him out. Where Lady Naga, you could kind of see, like, we don't really see it in these chapters, but it seems like she didn't have anybody on her side. It was just her solo stuff. Like, she was given this mission, and because she was so good at her missions that she never worked with any other heroes. She was just working for straight up the Government Safety Commission, unlike Hawks, who was, he is working for the Safety Commission, but he's also part of the Hero Society. He's a public facing member. So I do like that whole thing of what her role is, and then just kind of what she represents as well, because we're seeing more and more as this series is going on that the government is not the best, like, as we as we know, the government's not to be, and right. We're slowly peeling back those layers of how this entire hero society that kind of we were introduced to with All Might, and like how he was shepherding this like very positive world where like the heroes were the top of the game, like they were the top of the mountain and everybody looked up to them. And you could also see that how without All Might being around again, how just the world is like easily crumbled. Like Lady Nagat is totally right that it is such a fragile society that without All Might around, even though you have Endeavor, Hawks, and Best Genius, who are great heroes in terms of just the hero game, but they have so much shady stuff in their own past, and stuff the way they act is not like All Might. They are very much not All Might at all. Mm-hmm. And you can see that almost the Hero Society is turning into what they are.
Yeah.
And it kind of goes back into like kind of almost DC Comics and comics of like how the DC universe is shaped around Superman, really. And like how it's all based around Superman. And if it was based around Batman, it would be a much darker place.
Yeah.
Like if you don't have that moral compass, then it kind of all just goes to crap. Like kind of we see it, that Endeavor and Hawks and Best Genius have to deal with like protesters against them. So,
right.
So it's very, very interesting. What did you think of Deku in these chapters in terms of how, like him using all his quirks and everything?
I like it. You know, honestly, Deku, I think from a power standpoint, I like what Horikoshi is doing with him. I really do. I think he's doing a nice job slowly building out Deku's power base and his proficiency in using these various quirks. And we got a new wrinkle, right, with this one, where he's trying to use two different quirks parallel to each other, which is really interesting and something completely new as well. So I like that that Horikoshi's getting more into his different quirks, getting into him, being able to, because eventually, you know, it has to be the end result, right, Kevin, that he can use all the quirks at the same time, right? Yeah. Like a full-fledged American style superhero can. I gotta think that's gotta be the end result.
Yeah.
So from the power standpoint, I'm really liking it. You know, from a character standpoint, I gotta tell you, Kevin, Deku's character, you know, over these chapters, he's kind of taken a backseat character-wise. His personality is nowhere near. I mean, it's obviously his personality is not as big as Lady Nagant's personality, obviously. So he kind of gets overshadowed by her a lot. But I think his character, his personality isn't as big as some of the other heroes as well. He continues to be like that little sapling in the shade of a lot of big towering trees around him, you know? And so I think his personality continues to be, at least here, you know, in this current story arc, his personality is a little, just a little bland, a little on the back burner compared to everyone else.
Yeah, and I do think that part of that is because Lady Nagat takes such center stage in these chapters, and it's about learning about her and kind of putting her over, because this is basically, this really about putting her over as a villain, and she's not going to be a one-time villain like we saw with Muscular, and when like Muscular was just there to basically put over Deku's current time skip power. So and kind of and it's clear that Lady Nagat is not just like a one-time villain, like kind of like you thought that when she first appeared in chapter 311 when
I did, actually, you're right.
They're like, oh, she's just another assassin villain that is going to be after Deku has to make a run for it, and it's just kind of trying. At first you think that Lady Nagat is there just to kind of emphasize, oh, there's a lot of villains after him, but it's not just that, and Horikoshi, he obviously wants to make Lady Nagat kind of like Stain, making much bigger than like this story and bigger part of just how things are going. And she's almost the anti-Hawks, like I said. Yeah. And So it's going to be very interesting to see where they go with Deku, because we are seeing him rush his training a lot. Because even with like he clearly has control of the mostly control of the Danger Sense quirk and the Black Whip quirk. He's very proficient in those two, but we see that here he's starting to push himself again, like he did at the beginning of the series. He's pushing himself with the smokescreen quirk of not going full power with it, and when he's not properly trained in that, like he's trained a little bit to use in full power, but not to like properly strategize everything about it and how to maximize the smokescreen quirk. It seems like at least that's user that had the smokescreen quirk, and even tells him like, why are you doing this? And then even with the Fajin quirk that he uses, like with that's the kinetic energy that clones that he creates, he uses that again, like without even training. And so it's like, we're seeing him be a little reckless, and we're seeing what it's like when he doesn't have All Might around to like kind of watch over his shoulder. And you could kind of tell, and that's the one thing I did like about it, is that Lady Nagat took out the phone, and that put Deku in a position where he's like, oh, I don't have any backup. I can't contact Endeavor, Hawks, Best Genius to back me up here. Like I could have with maybe Muscular if things went south with him. And so it's kind of like, this is him on his own. This is really the first villain where he knows mentally that he's taking on his own, and he has no backup plan. Yep. So it's kind of, it's very interesting to see him actually do this. And I feel like this is more so than the Muscular fight of like his first actual villain fight.
I totally agree. This is, he's going against a big time villain on his own for the first time. And he's kind of just going to learn this. He's going to do on the job training, Kevin.
Yeah.
There's no time to prep before this fight. It's all on the job training with these quirks. And it's either going to look in prior. It's be interesting to see if it's going to be like how it was in the beginning, where he would break his body up, you know, trying to use the All Might's power too much, too quickly. I'd curious to see if in this fight with Lady Nagant, if he's going to end up, if this trial by fire is going to help him kind of speed up his learning curve, or is he just going to get trashed and have to get saved at the last minute?
Yeah, and I think that it's going to be I do feel like it's going on the case of, in terms of that Endeavor and the others will show up to run Lady Nagant off. Again, that's where I see things going. I'm not sure if that is where it's going to go, but I kind of see it that way, especially because you want Lady Nagat, because she's such a badass character of like, you want her to be around and like another, like it feels like this is just a fight of the first fight of many that they're going to have eventually. And I do also kind of want to see an actual training arc from Deku, because we kind of time skipped kind of like all his training. And it feels like, especially with the third user calling out Deku for not training in the Fajin quirk, it would be kind of cheap if we don't see him actually do some training into this series. Like this series has kind of gone away from training Deku.
Yeah.
And he's just like, even in the Paranormal Liberation War arc, we kind of time skipped a couple months there too. And we automatically saw him already jump a couple steps in terms of how much of One for All he could use. So I kind of hope that like maybe this is all just leading to more like, oh, All Might actually has to train you. And I want to see the All Might Deku training.
I'm totally on board with you on that too. I think the skipping the time skips and missing some of the training is not what's best for this manga in particular, or this type of manga. And I would love for Lady Nagant to be able to have the upper hand throughout this fight. And for Endeavor to have to come in at the last second, kind of sneak Deku out of there, right? Sneak him out of there and make the quick getaway, and then so you give Lady Nagant the clean win on this one, and then you give Deku his target, right? You give him his big bad that is now going to be his mountain that he's got to climb, right? His big quest that he has to defeat Lady Nagant, and then show his training with All Might. And that will also give us a little bit more of the chemistry between All Might and Deku, which I like as well. And then he can train up, and then he can face off against Lady Nagant again to get his eventual big hero win. That's what I would like to see. I mean, we may not get that, but that's what I would like to see.
And I wouldn't mind that, because Lady Nagat obviously is just one part of the Lydia villain. So I feel like it's good to establish like kind of these mid bosses for when eventually when we get to Tomodachi Shigaraki and Yep. And All for One, like, it's good to establish these, like, kind of like Dobby is,
yeah,
and all, kind of all the other top tier League of Villains members. Mm-hmm. So it's good to add like this outside member that we haven't seen before. And I also am very curious to see what is going to go on with All Might, because again, we kind of get a tease with this, like, mm-hmm. where obviously he doesn't die, but like, right. I feel like this series is continuously teasing that this year at some point All Might is going to have to die. It feels like
I agree.
And even with his, like, he does, like, they do a good job of, like, even though he doesn't have his powers anymore, he has this intimidating aura that even though the heroes, like, the villains, knowing that All Might has no powers, they back down because of his aura. So I really like that. And I kind of hope that they maybe, because they teased this with the Hercules card that he has, which is great that it's called Hercules. I love that.
I love that. I love that car. That is a great name.
I love that. But I kind of hope that this is kind of just a tease of also that All Might is, like, rich, because they've kind of said that All Might has a lot of money.
Right.
And I feel like this is kind of set up of him now going to be using that money to kind of almost become like the Tony Stark and Bruce Wayne of this series of, like, he's going, and I feel like that's kind of the direction that they're going with All Might, is that it is honestly, like, it feels that one of the steps before Deku could fight All for One in his final battle is going to be that All Might has to die.
Agreed.
And I could see him becoming like kind of Iron Man-esque, where he trades armor and stuff like that, because we see that he has a lot of American influence in his character.
Yes. Oh yeah.
And
yeah,
I could see that that's kind of direction for him, because it feels like he's going to be one of the characters that falls in battle. Mm-hmm. And it just, everything is pointing towards that. So it's going to be very interesting to see where they go for there.
Yeah, I think you're spot on with that. I really do. And I'd love that direction. I think that Tony Stark direction for All Might would be really cool.
Yeah. So it's going to be very interesting. That was this month's My Hero Academia chapters. Is there any other final thoughts you had on what we saw?
No, just great. We didn't touch on the artwork, but as always, the art's great. Yeah. Action's awesome. Characters look fantastic. I like Leighton Gunn's design. So we didn't touch on the art, but it's as good as always.
Yeah. All right. So what do you rate this May chapters of My Hero Academia?
You know, Kevin, I'm gonna go pretty high, because I really like Leighton Gunn as a villain. I think this is just this is how I like my villains. So I'm gonna give it 9 night girls out of 10 for the story, 8 night girls out of 10 for the art.
Yeah. You know what? I'm right there with you. 9 night girls out of 10 for the story and 8 night girls out of 10 for the arc. This is how you do villain introductions. Like, it, for any sort of villain in any sort of type of genre, this is how you do it. And like, where you're mixing great character work and action at the same time for them. And I'm very excited for what the next month's chapters will be. So, all right. So we'll move on to our next manga that we're going to be covering, is Kaiju number 8, that released their chapter 33 through 35 this month. So we start off with the aftermath of everybody finding out that Kafka is the Kaiju number 8. So because that was revealed to the third division, obviously that goes up to the defense force higher ups, and the defense force directors all talk about what they need to do next with Kaiju number 8, Kafka. And so Isao Shinomiya, who's the father of Kikuru Shinomiya, the member of the third division, and he is the director of the General Defense Force, for those who might not remember, orders for Kafka to be handed over to the Defense Force's main headquarters so that they could basically experiment on him and other stuff that they normally do to the Kaiju numbers. Back in the third division, as Kafka is being taken by Mina to the transport vehicle, he's thinking that everybody in the third division hates him now because he kept this secret of being Kaiju number 8 from all of them. But luckily for him, Lino speaks up and tells him, hey, we still believe in you, and I believe that you'll be joining us again someday. So kind of lifting up Kafka's spirit. And as the transport vehicle is shut, Mina calls out Lino for talking up that way. He shouldn't do that as one of the grunts. But Mina also assures Kafka that she also believes in him and that everybody in the third division is his friend. So they are going to do their best to tell the defense force that he is a normal person. He is one of them. So, which makes Kafka very happy, especially since Mina confirms that she still remembers their promise and that he wants to fulfill that promise after hearing Mina's positive words to him. So, but things in at the Defense Force headquarters still aren't looking great for Kafka, who's locked up in a high security prison cell. And it's here that Kikuru tries to argue with her dad to let Kafka go because he's done a lot of good. He's protected her and things like that. But Isao reminds her that he is just a kaiju at the end of the day, and shows him like these X-rays that show that he's not his physiology is not human anymore. It's more kaiju. But as that discussion is going on, back at the Third Division, Mina informs Lino, Aoi, Kaguri, and Iharu Furuhashi that they are actually going to be transferred to the other divisions in the Defense Force because any punishment or anything, but it's because they are such talented individuals that they need to spread those talents across the other divisions that maybe aren't as strong as the Third Division. And so they all said, even though they want to help out Kafka, they know that this is what they need to do. So they all agree to. And back at the Defense Force headquarters, Isao brings a whole army of people with him to where Kafka's being held up. The heat end, and he has Kafka be released so that way he could show his daughter that Kafka is who is just the kaiju number 8. So he brings out these huge gauntlets that are just like massive gauntlets that are actually powered by the kaiju number 8 parts, or kaiju number 2 parts, I'm sorry, that were harvested when they took down that kaiju. And Isao just completely overwhelms Kafka. Even when Kafka transforms into kaiju number 8, like Isao just demolishes him the entire time. And and that's kind of where we end things, with Kafka things looking bleak for Kafka, and Isao just ready to finish him off and likely harvest his parts and everything, you know, like they do with the other kaiju. So what do you think of these chapters, Rock?
This was awesome. This was absolutely fantastic. I love the chapters for May. Look, make no mistake, Kaiju number 8 is still number 1 on Rock's list of manga titles right now, and for good reason. This manga is just so, it's just so good. It is so much fun. Every single chapter is an absolute blast to read. I always have a fun time. And what's great about Kaiju number 8 is, Kevin, I swear, I tear through these chapters faster than any other manga I read. And it's because they're so much fun. You're just like, it's like when you're a kid and you're eating candy and you just like shovel down as much candy as possible, as quickly as possible. That's how I am with these chapters. They're wonderful. I mean, what can you say? You've got, again, you get a wonderful mix. Matsumoto continues to show that he is a master at character work, at world building, and by far anything else, amazing action, right? And he knows how to pace it perfectly. He really does. And with this, the character work is cool because you see all of Kafka's friends in the Third Division, kind of they're throwing their support behind Kafka, which is really nice to see. Again, you see how Kafka, even though he's older than everyone else, even though he was a low performer in the academy, tested poorly, was a lower rank, right? Didn't become a full member until after everybody else. Despite all of that, he has earned the love and respect from all of his teammates, despite not being the best, right? Despite having all of these faults, he's earned their respect, their undying respect. They all love him. And I liked how Matsumoto makes a point of showing how all of his teammates love this guy. Even ones that didn't like him initially, may have thought he was an idiot initially, he's won his whole team over, which is very nice to see. I like to see the characters growing together like that. That's important for any shonen manga, of course, right? So that's cool to see. And then we finally get to meet the director general, right? And he is just, wow. He's an awesome, awesome character. I absolutely love him. I was won over. Isao is amazing. And what's cool about him is, yeah, he's no longer, I mean, he's not active duty anymore, right? Because he's the head man in charge. So he doesn't have to be in a strike force or on a team. So this is great for a couple reasons. So what I love about it is that Matsumoto makes sure that you know dear reader, that Isao may not be active duty anymore, but he can absolutely demolish anybody. Like, end of story, right? Like, this, you've been building up, like, his daughter got built up as being a heavy hitter. Mina's gotten built up as being a heavy hitter. Okay, that's cute. Asao, that guy can demolish anybody. And I like that that Matsumoto gets over, like, this guy here. Yeah, he's kind of like Yoda from the prequels. You don't see him fight much, but when you do, you know he's the best, right? And also what I like about it is Matsumoto continues to give us a nice diversity in ages of characters, which, again, you don't see in a lot of shonen manga, right? And he continues to do that. Kafka being, you know, in his 30s, right? Which is unusual for a main character of a shonen manga. And here, the director general is obviously, I mean, look, he's got to be, they don't tell you how old he is, but you figure he's probably what, like in his 50s, I'm thinking, something in that area.
Yeah, like 40s, 50s.
Right. So, being portrayed as being, you know, a total badass. Like, I dig that Matsumoto's like, yeah, we don't have to give you just an endless stream of 14 to 17 year olds, right?
Yeah.
It's just unique for the genre, is all I'm saying. And he's a cool character. And his power set, Kevin, come on. Did you not just get up and geek out when he fired up the gauntlets and then boom, slammed his fist together Hulk style, right? That was cool, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was great. And again, and the character actually honestly reminds me a lot of the Fuhrer from Full Metal Alchemist.
Yeah.
This is kind of like this older character that you don't you kind of just see in the leadership position, but when he it goes in action, he's like the most badass character and like one of the end game bosses or whatever.
Yes.
So that's kind of, he reminds me a lot of that. At least that's when I was reading that chapter, I was like, oh man, he reminds me a lot of that Fuhrer from Full Metal Alchemist. Yeah.
Kaiju number two looks like Godzilla.
Yeah. Yep.
Similar body type to like the Godzilla. He's from like 1972, which is like, you know, that arrow. You know, it's like, oh, I like that. That was perfect, you know?
Yeah, and I like that too, because it's like subtle things of going back into how, like, what kind of danger Kafka's in, because they talk about it of like the gauntlets that Isao is using are made out of body parts from that Kaiju number two. And I think that's, again, just doing a lot of visual stuff of like, oh, this is what Kafka is in super danger, because it's not just about him dying, but he's basically seen as an experiment now.
Right.
And so it's like he's just fighting for survival in multiple different ways. I do like that whole visual storytelling and just telling like of the story of like, and also further expanding of like what the Defense Force does and just how the government works as well, because we once again see, like, during that meeting before Kafka gets transferred, them talk about, like, Kaiju number 9, saying that, hey, he's on a similar, Kaiju number 8 is a similar level, and they even talk about how there's a lot of secrets within the government, too, because there's stuff that they don't even, like, only these higher, top-tier Defense Force members know about how they really deal with the Kaiju and all the other stuff that they do with the Defense Force. It seems like there's, again, it's teasing out that there's much more to this world than what we already know, which is great, because again, you want to, especially with the Kafka's reveal already like out in the open, there needs to be more to this manga, so that way and starting to tease that the Defense Force has a lot more secrets, and this government has a lot more secrets. It's going to be especially when it comes to dealing with Kaiju, and it kind of goes back into kind of what we talked about last time of, we don't really know why Kafka became a Kaiju. Like, there's a lot of stuff of we kind of get an idea that there's this secret Kaiju organization as well, but we don't know if they're connected to the Defense Force or if there's other things going on, and this kind of furthers that mystery of like, what is actually going on in this world?
We actually, despite the fact that we get lots of cool, you know, character work and really cool action, again, we get lots of good world building. Like, to your point, we get a lot more information on the government, on this whole, the director dealing with Kaiju. What's really neat is Matsumoto has managed to build a world that feels lived in, because we have Kaiju's number 1 through 7, right? That they've harvested to make weapons. And we know that Kaiju number 2 is
the Isao's weapons.
Right. Those are his weapons. And that's from 72. So this is a world that's really been lived in, which unlike, you know, sometimes in a manga where you begin that world at the kind of in the starting point, you know what I'm saying, of what's going on. I like that Matsumoto makes sure that this world feels, it has some age on it.
Yeah.
It's really been lived in. There's a nice history to it, a real history, but at the same time, it's a history that he's being very judicious in how much he tells us about to kind of pique our interest and keep us coming back for more. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it kind of reminds me almost of like Naruto in a little bit of that way, because like with Naruto, we had kind of similar thing of like where Naruto's secret kind of came out very quickly as well. Like even though only like the Leaf Village knew about it, everybody starts knowing about it very quickly, but it wasn't, the series wasn't about that. It was like, there was this so much more history to the world that like over time we learned about it. And I feel like Kaiju number 8 is kind of heading in that direction where now that Kafka's secret is in the open, which was, we felt like was the big secret of this series, kind of like traditional superhero comics are.
Yeah.
But now that it's open, I feel like now we're going to just be digging into the world itself.
And you and I were talked about that in the last podcast about what did Matsumoto reveal, you know, Kafka's secret identity too early, right? Because I won't speak for you, but I think, you know, for certainly for me, and I think you and I were in agreement that I think maybe we were looking at it like the traditional American superhero viewpoint of where that's, you know, the secret identity is a real central plot line to the title. And I really thought that was the main one. But since he revealed it, and since we progressed from the moment he revealed it to now, with all these chapters in between, I'm realizing, oh, yeah, that isn't the big secret. The big secret is all these other Daikaiju and how they've harvested them for these weapons and the government and what their deal is with Kaiju and how they handle Kaiju and why they approach them a certain way. Yeah. And the whole Kaiju organization that we're just learning about with Kaiju number 9. And by the way, Kevin, the big twist that we got in this month, that Kafka doesn't transform from human into Kaiju. I thought he was like a Henshin style superhero, you know, who transformed from human to superhuman, in his case, human to Kaiju. We find out, no, even in human form, he has a Kaiju core in his body, in his chest, where you and I would have our hearts.
Yeah.
So he's not a traditional Henshin superhero either, who transforms from human to superhuman.
Yeah.
He's totally changed. So that's a big wrinkle. So I'm realizing that, okay, him being out as Kaiju number 8 really isn't the big secret. And he's revealed, Matsumoto's given us so much more since then with Kaiju, with Kafka's physical makeup, even while he's in human form, with the government and everything else going on, that there is so, the bigger questions are out there, that Kafka's secret identity was actually just the low hanging fruit, which makes me excited.
Yeah, and I think outside of Kafka and Isao, like the other standout character for me was Mina in these chapters, was because again, we see that like in April's chapters, we kind of felt like, oh, Mina's going to be pissed off at Kafka, but we kind of learned that she's just kind of doing what her job is, because again, she is the captain of the Third Division, and it's not just, it just can't be just about her friendship with Kafka and her history with him. She does have a job to play, and again, just playing up that she understands her role, and that she must have some sort of sense of professionalism in this world, or else everybody's going to question her authority, and she can't have that at all as a captain. So she can't drop her guard until like she's in a private meeting with Kafka where no one else could hear her. But I just like that personality of like, you know what, she is one of the authority figures in this world, and she's always the one in charge. And she, even though she doesn't want to make this decision, as she makes it clear to Kafka, like, hey, we're still friends. I still remember our promise and things like that. So, and she still believes in Kafka for that. At the end of the day, that they are going to end up being paired up of working together and fulfilling the promise that they made as kids. And kind of just like that dichotomy of like switching between her relationship with Kafka and then her going back into captain mode when she tells Lino and the others that, hey, you're being transferred, and telling them in a very positive manner of like, hey, you guys are not being transferred because of punishment or because Lino spoke up or anything like that. It's because you guys are super talented, and the rest of the Defense Force needs you guys because they're not as good as us. And it's just kind of talking them up and just seeing her as a leader, like being presented as a leader and always knowing the situation at hand and what she needs to be doing in terms of how she talks to others. Because we already know that she's an incredible badass from the last story. Like, we know that she's a top tier character in terms of power, but and authority. So And we're starting to see that leadership coming out of her as well here, where it's not just her being silent like she was at the beginning of the series.
Yeah, for me, I agree with you. I think that Mina's character finally got the much needed character work that Matsumoto had not given her up to this point. To me, honestly, Mina came across more of a typical manga archetype than she did an actual character. And for the first time ever in chapter 33 this month, she finally became a character. You know what I mean? And she was cool in the fight scenes, don't get me wrong, but for the first time, I actually found her interesting as a character.
Yeah, she's not positioned as just a love interest or just right. Like kind of a goal to achieve for the main character. She's actually like more a fully realized character.
Yeah, exactly. So I like that. I think it was, honestly, it was about time Matsumoto got to that point. So yeah. I'm glad he finally got us there, and you got to see her compassion. You got to see her kindness. You got to see her love, her support, all these facets of someone's personality that makes them a human.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. She's not just a machine. Like, because a lot of the times we just see her with like a stoic look on her face, and that, cause again, she is at the end of the day, a captain of the third division. So she does need to have some of that stoicism, but definitely. At the end of the day, but you still want to see more to her character than just that, or like her turning out to be a tsundere or whatever. There's much more depth to the character, which is always good to have.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then I also, even though they don't get too much time to shine here, like they've done earlier in the series, I do like that they're that the series is continuing to develop like Kikaru and Lino as like Kafka's best friends in the series. Yep. And like they still believe in Kafka and everything. And even though Kikaru especially, it has to see her, that fight in Kafka and the shocked expression she has as like one of the audience members. Like, I still like that she believes in Kafka. It's still good. It's good that, again, just kind of like Mina, that people aren't pissed off at Kafka for like revealing his secret and all that stuff like we would normally see in these type of stories, where like once the big secret's out, what part of that story is that everybody's pissed off that he revealed it or that he's not, or that he kept it from them. And I'm like, that's not what the story is anymore.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought the part about with Kikaru as well, because that was a character that, you know, honestly, beginning of the manga, I was like, meh, okay, fine. Again, more of an archetype than a character, you know? Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, whatever, meh. But she started to grow on me, right? Mm-hmm. Especially once she found out that Kafka was Kaiju number 8 and she kept the secret, okay? At that point, she started to grow on me. Well, let me tell you what. In chapters 33, 34, and 35, she really grows on me a lot. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I think the scene where she confronts her father over Kafka. And her father, dude, he just sticks the knife in her. Like, don't remind me of your greatest failures. Where Kafka had to turn into Kaiju number 8 to save Kikaru, right? And her dad's like, don't remind me of when you failed. Like, it reaffirms what a mean daddy was that we got hinted to. You remember in the beginning of the manga?
Yeah.
Telling stories. Hey. It's like, oh, damn, dad. And then, but her, in spite of that, not wavering in her support of Kafka, right? And then seeing the fight where her dad's just, he's going to kill Kafka. Yeah. Clearly. Okay. He's just overpowering. And Kikaru is just horrified for Kafka. To see that kind of compassion and love, I use the word love, not romantic love, but love for, you know, a close friend.
As a friend.
Right. Yeah. You know, your love for your friend. To see that kind of love, compassion, and support and horror, right? It really made her character grow on me. Again, it showed more nuance to her personality and to her character than we'd seen up to this point. And it also showed that she is a great friend. She is someone that, you know, she didn't like Kafka originally, but he won her over. And when he won her over, she's like one of those people. You win her over, she's by your side no matter what.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's... Yeah, and I enjoy that we're just starting to see the world open up a little bit more in terms of not just the world itself, but the characters as well. And like, now it's about what the ramifications of Kafka's reveal is, and like, it's a lot more depth than I thought they would do. And like, and so I'm very glad about that.
Did you know? I forgot. Did mm-hmm. Did we know that Kikuru's mother was killed by Kaiju?
It kind of was talked about when in her introduction a little bit, that's why she was like just with her dad, and why she's trying to act more like kind of almost like a male in this male dominated world. Right. So her tough personality.
I couldn't remember if we knew that or not.
I would have to go back and read it, but I feel like it was like during her character introduction.
But I mean, I was just like, this poor girl, mom dies, and her dad, that's just the worst dad of the year, Kevin.
Yeah, and the thing with her dad, and just going back to Isao, is that I do like that he just never turns it off in terms of being the director.
Even with
Kikuru, he's like
all the time.
You could kind of tell, like, even with her, like when she was talking about her story and everything, that her dad, as soon as he got the director job, and probably like since her mom died, he was in director mode the entire time, because he has this thing against the kaiju and everything. So it's kind of just going again, all going back to the world and like what we don't know about this world. Yep. And we don't know about the history, really, because we only see like brief flashes of the other kaijus that have attacked and all that stuff. So I'm very excited to see what they do in terms of exploring what the history of this world is and how that relates to what's going on right now.
Totally. I totally agree.
So, all right. Awesome. So what would you grade these chapters for kaiju number 8?
Wow. Well, before I give you my grade, we got to make mention, as always, Matsumoto's art is awesome.
Oh yeah.
He is a great, great artist. His action is oh so good. It is oh so good. I'm going to go, Kevin, I hate to say it, but I'm going to go 9 girls out of 10 again for the story. I just thought we got some good chapters this month of May. Really good chapters. And the art, I'm always going to come high on the art grade for Matsumoto. I'm going to give him 9 girls out of 10 as well.
Yeah, so for me, I'm going a little bit lower, but it's still going to be high. I'm going to go 8 girls out of 10 for both the art and story. Again, these are all really entertaining. I'm really excited to see what they do with this world that Kaiju number 8 exists in. So it's going to be really fun. So from there, we're going to hit up Spy X Family, which released their chapters 45 through 47. So these chapters continue the mission that the Thorn Princess is on with your guarding... top tier gangster family that now only has 2 surviving members in. So she is, while she is set to guard Oka and her son, Anya and Lloyd are also on board this cruise ship that is filled with assassins and hitmen and hit women and all that. At first, Oka is left to be just in her room, but she kind of convinces Yor to, hey, I want to go out. The kid is fidgety and everything and crying, so he kind of wants to get some fresh air. Yor sees the kid and she kind of says, okay, we'll do it. And luckily for them, they don't run into any assassins or anything like that while they're outside. But it's here where we start kind of digging more into kind of Yor. She does want this to be kind of her final mission, and she does want to kind of settle down with her family that she has with Lloyd and Anya. And so we're kind of getting more hints of that. But as all that's going on, again, Anya and Lloyd are on this ship as well, so they're enjoying themselves. And while Yor is able to protect Oka for the most part, and they go to this dinner where, again, nothing happens, but they discuss more of the mission and how, like, they're at any moment any assassin could attack. Eventually, Yor's partners in protecting Oka do notice a couple assassins. They take them out, but they realize that these assassins that they just took out, that they noticed, were noticed on purpose, and that someone's going to probably attack Oka's room. As they're heading over there, they're still too late, and there's a knock at the door. Yor realizes that that's probably an assassin, quickly protects Oka, makes sure that she's in cover, and then takes out the assassin very quickly. And so with this attack in Oka's room, Yor and her partners realize that she's no longer safe. They try and get her through this masquerade ballroom and like disguise her as best they can. But obviously the disguise don't work. The masquerade is basically filled with assassins and hitmen and hitwomen. So they are very much in deep trouble. And they, as that a fight breaks out throughout the masquerade ball, we see that Anya and Lloyd are in the gift shop buying something. So, and that's kind of where we leave things at, where with Anya and Lloyd buying something at the gift shop while Yor is busy being her Thorn Princess thing of protecting Oka. So really, these were short and sweet chapters, but a lot still happens in terms of character development. What did you think of these made chapters for Spy X Family.
Spy X Family is my, it's my weakness. I just adore these characters so much. I just love all these characters. The action's great. Don't get me wrong. And the world is very cool. But man, what gets me coming back every chapter are the characters. I just love them so much. They're wonderful. They're like real people to me. That's to me, that's the magic sauce to this manga. Even though there's, believe me, so much else in here that to enjoy and to love for sure. I thought this month was, you know, we were talking before we recorded this month. I would say the first two chapters of the month were a bit, I don't want to say uneventful, you know, not a lot happened. They did offer, as always, every chapter, whether there's not much action or not a lot of plot progression, you will get great character work. Okay. So I would say that the first two chapters in May, 45 and 46, great character work, but not a lot going on, but man, did things pick up with chapter 47? It got crazy with that chapter. So that's when all the action hit. And Endo, again, it's amazing how he's able to. Endo shines. Look, don't get me wrong. The action in chapter 47 is awesome. And I do want to talk about that with you. But what made these three chapters in May so much fun are the little moments. It's Anya really excited when she first sees the cruise ship and how amazing it is, right? And how grand it is and fancy. And then they get to their room because they're third class, staying in third class on the ship. They get to the room. She's like, oh, is this where they keep the prisoners? You know, I mean, it's and then it's like that kind of little moment where Lloyd is still in super spy mode, right? And then he realizes, no, for my mission, I have to be here. Like, my mission is actually to be on vacation, not to be in spy mode, but it's still a mission, right, Kevin? That's the funny. But I had to be on vacation mode. So wait, I must attack this with intense ferocity of vacation to vacation. So he attacks vacationing, Kevin, like he does spy work with all this intensity. That was funny. And then moments of like, Anya throwing a fit when she wants some like overpriced merchandise at some merchandise stand. And Lloyd's like, does a good parent buy it for the kid or does a good parent not buy it for the kid? You know, because he wants to keep his cover, right? And then the small moments between when the woman that we're protecting, Olga, that is being protected, there's a few moments between Yor and Olga where they're very quiet, very intimate, kind of a conversation you see between a mother and a woman who is thinking of being a mother. You know what I mean? And kind of the unique situation that really only a mom ever experiences when it comes to children. Like, not even a dad really gets it. It's really a mom thing. And that was a nice quiet moment to show what an introspective moment for Yor when she's quote unquote on the job as the Thorn Princess assassin. Right. So for me, the magic in these three chapters of May are all these, it's these little moments that honestly, Kevin, I think are just, they're just beautifully written and they're done in such a succinct fashion too, which is, it's amazing how much he can do in such little panel space.
Yeah. And I think, you are totally right about that. It's like, I think the character work here is, it's like at its best for this series really. And I think this is where also like the Endo's artwork is just like the so well telling the story as well, because even though we get a lot of dialogue, especially with Yor and Lloyd and Anya in terms of, especially Lloyd and Yor, of what, where they are at in their lives and everything. And especially this mission for Lloyd's case of, and a lot of that is, I feel like, more visually told than it is told by through the dialogue. And I think that's where the artwork really shines the best, is that it's a lot of visual. It's a lot, like, you could easily just look at the panels and be like, oh, they are very much thinking about what the current situation they're in, whether it's your, like, do I need to just retire? And in Lloyd's case of, like, he stresses himself out because he's on a mission. And he's always on mission mode. And when it comes like, oh, do I have to be a dad or do I have to be a... super spy assassin, but he's always on mission mode. So,
uh-huh.
But again, a lot of that is visually storytelling. Obviously, Anya's her super expressive comedic enough that she's always bringing the lightheartedness of this. Yes. And so,
yes.
Again, I think that that's where I think for these chapters, the art especially shines a lot. And also just the character work in general of all three characters, but yours especially, like I just really enjoy what they're doing with yours character, making you wonder, hey, is she really actually going to retire from being Thorn Princess? But we see that this job is a lot more than maybe she could even retire, but also now we are starting to get that tease of, oh, her Thorn Princess side is actually very close to getting out into open to her family because Anya and Lloyd are right there. So it's going to be very interesting to see if this is where kind of the breaking point for her, and if we're also going to start seeing that Lloyd discovers her secret, because we know that Anya already knows thanks to her psychic powers, but now it's about the Lloyd aspect of it. And I like that that's where we end this month of like seeing that, even though there's the comedic thing of Lloyd buying something for Anya in the gift shop, but right around the room is the big assassin fight that's going down. So it's kind of it's a comedic moment, but when you look at it again, it's also, oh, is this where we're going to find out more of, like, for Lloyd's side of things, he's going to find out about Yor and everything. So it's kind of, it's a good teaser to have.
Yep. Agreed. And you speak of the assassin scene going on the corner. When we finally get the fighting, Kevin, which is probably around the middle of chapter 46 and then to 47, we get the fighting, right? When we finally get to the fighting, were you as surprised as I was that old Mr. McMahon, this dude looks like he's in his late 60s, right? Wearing glasses, old guy. Who knew he was like this total badass, Kevin, as he's just ripping through people? I totally geeked out at that moment. I was like, I love it. When you see old guys like that just turn out to be total badasses, hilarious.
Yeah.
Always entertains me. So I thought that was a fun surprise, right? That he's this total badass just taking people out left and right. That was cool action. And then what really, and this is what Endo's charm, because Endo's not going to do anything. He's able to bring charm to almost everything, right? And it's easy to deliver uber violent action. You know, look, is there an art to it? Sure, but I think it's easy to deliver, okay, just to be uber violent. Endo, though, purposely paints himself into a situation where he has to be creative, because in the big assassin fight scene you're talking about, it's at that big masquerade party, Yor can't use any overt violence or killing without outing herself, right? So she has to do all these like covert things to take out the bad guys to make it look like they're too drunk and are passing out because they're too drunk, right? Like it's one guy with a button, clicks him with a button, another guy she dances with, right? And then it's like, but I'm married and this is inappropriate. And she ends up like, you know, cracking his hands and knocking him out when no one's looking, and he kind of like passes out like he's drunk, you know? So they both look like they're drunk, and the bartender's like, oh, sir, we can't serve you anymore. You have to leave now. Like that was a really fun, creative way to have a fight scene other than the typical hack and slash super bloody fight scene. You know what I mean? It very creative and unique.
Yeah. And I think that like the only thing that I would say against these chapters is just that, and this series in general, is that I kind of am hoping that we start seeing more long-term antagonists being built up eventually.
That's a fair criticism.
Because I think the one thing that this story arc in particular is suffering is that we don't have any recognizable faces on the antagonism side of things.
You're right.
I think this series hasn't really built up any like major long-term antagonist. And I think we maybe are going to see it with the guy that keeps hiding in his room with all like the computers surrounding him. I'm not sure if he's being built up to be a long-term antagonist or anything like that.
Oracle of the bad guys.
Yeah. but at the same time, it's like he's still not enough, because it's like, I think that's the only thing that's holding this series back from being maybe that next year. Obviously, it's more of a comedic action series, like it leans into comedy side of things. But I think now that we're getting this deep into the series, I think, and we're starting to see it with this arc, is just more of the antagonists inside, because we got the protagonists like Lloyd, Anya, and Yor. They are really great characters, but now it would be cool to see a assassin we would recognize that, oh, Yor is very much in trouble against this one, and we never feel like Yor is actually in trouble.
No, we don't. As a matter of fact, that's a great point to bring up and a very fair criticism, because we have not gotten that that big bad villain. For, to be honest, either for Yor or for Twilight.
Yeah.
Because really, have you felt like there's been any situation Twilight can't handle yet, or any human Twilight can't handle yet? No, you haven't felt that, and you haven't felt that way for Yor either. So they're both kind of two. They both need that threat, or whether it's separate for each one or a common one, I'm fine with whichever, right? Okay, you can make it a common antagonist or one for each. It's okay, but they need that that main antagonist who, when that antagonist appears, you're like, oh, they're in trouble.
Yeah, and because right now, like, the only antagonist that really is in the series is the antagonist of, like, them being discovered of their fake relationship. That's the only terms in I would say, quote unquote, antagonist is not actually anybody physically, but it's more their secret, their own secret of, like, being against them, of, like, how long can they keep it up?
Yeah, agreed. And you're right. We've gone far enough now at chapter 47. You know, this approach worked in the beginning for quite a while, but you're completely right. By chapter 47, it can't just be the mission that Lloyd is on. That can't be the main antagonist. It's not enough. You need some kind of physical threat out there. We need to get something. And we had no reoccurring characters, threats wise, no reoccurring ones. We need something at this point. And I would think Endo would get that, but it's also possible Endo's like, you know what? I'm going to treat this almost like I don't mean this literally, Kevin, of course, like an 80s sitcom where I got this gimmick and we're just going to play with it.
Yeah. And it kind of almost reminds me, because right now this series, even though it's like an action, it has a lot of action in it. It reminds me mostly of Slice of Life in terms of everything how in terms of the character work, because it's very much just about the protagonist.
Yep.
Obviously, there's going to be like the monster of the week type of we're going to have an antagonist for this story, but it's not going to be like, you're not going to see them again after this story anyways. Right. But a lot of just the character work, it just reminds me of like what I would read from a Slice of Life, really. Like, and that's what this series, and again, it's not a bad thing, because again, this series, I think we both enjoy and we both like, and it also gives us a series to talk about that's different from more of the action oriented, like My Hero and Dragon Ball and all this stuff. But at the same time, it's kind of for just the long-term future. I kind of do hope that they start introducing somebody that is more overarching than just the secret itself. That's kind of like my only thing. And that's kind of what I started realizing with these chapters of really, it is the secret. The secret is the main antagonist of this series. And I kind of want there to be more.
I'm with you on that. As much as I love the series, I agree with you on that.
But all right, cool. Is there any other final thoughts you had on these chapters for Spy X Family?
No, I mean, I you mentioned the art. I want to agree with you. The art is, because you talked about it in depth, so I won't add too much to it, but you're right. The art is gorgeous as always. Endo is a wonderful artist. His facial expressions are his calling card, I think. That's where he injects all the emotion into the story. His panels are just wonderful. I love it.
Okay. Yeah. All right, cool. And what would you grade out these chapters?
I'm going to go probably a little bit higher than I thought I would after, you know, I think the chapters kept getting better and better. Okay. So I think I'm going to end up going 8 Night Girls out of 10 for the story, 8 Night Girls out of 10 for the art.
Nice. All right, cool. Yeah. For me, I think in terms of the story itself, again, I think the antagonist thing is starting to bother me a little bit in this series. So, but I still overall enjoyed what the content is. And so I would say for the story itself is a 7 Night Girls out of 10 for me. And then the artwork is 8 Night Girls out of 10, just because I love the artwork so much. It does so much visual storytelling and it just maximizes that so well. So it's overall 7.5 Night Girls out of 10. Again, very solid chapters. All right, cool. And then now, so we'll be moving on to Dragon Ball Super, which released its chapter 71 this month. And so this is basically the big battle between Goku and Vegeta that we'll have against Granola. So they are taken over to meet Granola by Maki and Oil, who are working with Elect organization. So as soon as Goku and Vegeta meet Granola, Granola just starts blasting them with energy blasts all over. And so, and Goku and Vegeta, while they are able to dodge all the energy blasts, they are still, like, the barrage is so quick that they do need to transform. So Vegeta transforms into a Super Saiyan, but Goku decides, instead of transforming, he actually wants to use Ultra Instinct to dodge all the energy blast, While this is initially successful, Goku does end up getting hit by one of the energy blasts because he is so reliant on Ultra Instinct. And so he gets hit by a big blast in the back of his head that knocks him down. Goku, and this forces Vegeta to remind Goku that he hasn't actually mastered Ultra Instinct, so he's just forcing it. And Goku agrees with him, so he does go Super Saiyan. And again, this is where Granola finally meets up with Goku and Vegeta. And he kind of tells them that he's after Frieza, but he doesn't really reveal much else. And Granola then uses like another show of power against Goku and Vegeta, and is able to show that he is extremely powerful. So Vegeta tells Goku, hey, you know what? You just got hit by an energy blast. So why don't you try and get your revenge on Granola so you could take him on by yourself? And Goku is totally up for that. So like he always is, to take somebody on one-on-one. So Goku decides to transform into Super Saiyan God, his red form. And he combines the Super Saiyan God level with his Ultra Instinct to take on Granola. He is able to match up with Granola for the most part, but Granola actually just lures him in with all the attacks to strike him in one of his vital points, which completely knocks Goku off his feet. So, because Granola is able to use a hyperspeed that is even faster than his instant transmission that he was able to detect. So, it's here where Granola reveals that his whole mission in life now is to annihilate the Saiyans and Frieza because of what they did, like because he is the last survivor of his people. And so, to show this, Granola actually starts powering up into his own new form because he even reveals that he hates them so much that he gave up most of his life, all the years of his life except for 3 years, to become the strongest person in the universe. And so, seeing that how powerful Granola is, Goku decides to match him by going Super Saiyan Blue, and they continue their fight. And as Goku and Granola continue fighting in the air, Vegeta discovers a mysterious footprint that he recognizes on the ground, and that's kind of where we leave this chapter. Very, very action-oriented chapter for Dragon Ball Super. What did you think of overall what happened in Dragon Ball Super this month, Rock?
I thought this was chapter 72 was pretty solid. It kind of suffers a bit from, I think, what you and I talked about in the last podcast when it came to this current story arc. It suffers a bit that I don't think, and I think you were with me on this, that Granola was really built up properly enough for an antagonist for Vegeta and Goku. And because he wasn't built up enough, I guess my anticipation wasn't as high as it should have been for this fight. Yeah. And when the fight starts, you have a hard time figuring out, is Granola really that much of a threat? I haven't seen him do anything, and he's doing all these laser attacks, energy attacks, and Goku and Vegeta are pretty much snaking by all of them. Kind of like, what's this guy's, what's his gimmick? What's his power set? Why should I be? I guess I never felt any worry at all for Goku or Vegeta in the beginning at all. Even though they're getting bombarded by all these energy blasts, they're dodging all of them. And I never felt that dread that you normally get, or that feeling of angst or worry or tension. I just didn't get it. I think that once Goku was taken down the first time, okay, and Vegeta had to use the Senzo Bean to revive him. Okay, from that point on, I think the fight got a lot better. I think we got a better sense of what Granola can do. I think Granola came across more of a badass. And at that point, I think the reader, at least this reader, me, got more invested in the fight and got a little more nervous for our heroes in this fight. And I do like that Toriyama has Granola take down Goku a second time, but simply with very small, tiny pressure point strikes. No display of power, no big power moves. I mean, no, it is so opposite of how these fights normally go, right? With the big power moves and everything over the top. I actually like that because that kind of emphasized, okay, before this fight, we had no idea of what Granola's power set was, or we just were told he's really powerful, but okay, whatever. That seeing Goku take down a second time just with a little tap, that made the reader go, yeah. Oh, okay, that gets my attention.
Yeah.
This guy is a heavy hitter. And so at that point, the second time Goku gets taken down, I really started to get legitimately invested in the fight at that point. And then, of course, we end it with the big hook ending, right? With the paw print, footprint in the ground, and that tease. So for me, started slow, for me at least, but as it progressed, I think it built up steam and got me more and more interested in it. And ended it with a solid hook ending.
Yeah, and I kind of very much with you on that. It's, I think the problem that this entire chapter suffers is everything on Granola, and even like the villain side of like with Maki, Oil, Elect, and Gas. Like,
yeah,
this story just hasn't been built up the antagonist like very well. Oh. Like Maki, Oil, Elect, Gas, they are all just like so villains. Like we haven't seen them do anything. Like we're like, it never feels like Goku and Vegeta or any of the Z fighters are in danger against them. Like, obviously we know that Gas has been said that to be stronger than Frieza, but that we haven't actually seen that. It's like, you could talk about it, but it's not. And no, like, we don't recognize these characters. If it was, this was somebody like, let's say Ginyu or somebody that was talking about, oh, Gas is actually strong and stronger than Frieza, we would kind of start to believe it. But because these characters are so unknown and they could talk like, oh yeah, well, I'm stronger than this character, we don't really believe you because we don't know you.
Exactly.
So it's like, we need, like, that's what like with Boo, like kind of like going back to the Boo saga, like there was a lot of talk about Boo, but it was like, we started seeing, oh, like there's a Grand Kai talking about Boo, like being super strong. There's these godly figures that we know because based on like King, knowing King Kai and knowing what that part of the world is, like when we got to the Boo saga and when we got to Boo eventually being revealed, we're like, oh yeah, this guy is super strong. And as we see Goku, Vegeta, Gohan fighting the fighters that Babidi had against these Z fighters, they're all super powerful, but they're all super scared of Boo. And they're all working for that. So the eventual reveal of Boo was like, oh, we're all in trouble. And you never get that feeling with Granola. You never get that feeling with Gaz.
No.
Or any of the villains. And I think that's the biggest problem with the story arc is that you never get the feeling of concern. Even though, you know, Granola's super powerful, even though we see that he's super powerful because he's able to match up with Goku and Vegeta. I just never am concerned. I'm just not at the end of the day. And I think really it just shows that Granola is really probably like the weakest antagonist that we've seen in this series, because we've had in this series, we've had Hit, we've had Jiren, we had Moro, three characters that are incredibly powerful, and they were showcased as powerful. We knew going into it that they were in trouble because we heard the legend of each of these characters, and there was a sense of escalation when we got to see them actually fight.
Absolutely.
So each of those villains had this sense where when we finally got to them, we're like, man, we still don't know if Goku and Vegeta could fight them. And that was in Dragon Ball Super itself. Like, these are three characters that we were introduced to in Dragon Ball Super. And each time we saw them, we felt like, oh, they're in trouble. Like, because we know what came before them.
Right.
And with Granola, we don't know that. We haven't seen.
You're not worried, Kevin. At any point, you're not really worried, are you? No.
Yeah. Again, just going back to how just rushed this entire story arc has been, and we just haven't had that character development for the antagonist side of things. Obviously, when it comes to the Goku and Vegeta, I'm still invested in their story in terms of how they're growing in power, but even them, they are starting to get affected by their weak antagonist, because it's like, this story arc in general just kind of feels like filler, like where we would get a filler anime, and like when Dragon Ball Z with one of the filler arcs between the Android saga and the Frieza saga, it kind of feels like that, of like the Garlic Jr. saga. That's what this reminds me of, is the Garlic Jr. Where it's like, oh yeah, there's this powerful bad guy, but at the end of the day, we're just waiting for the actual next big story to happen. So
maybe Toriyama's busy with that movie, Kevin, so he needs this filler story arc in here.
Yeah, exactly. And I think obviously, like, I think and that's where I think for me the story is just, I'm just not connecting with it. The artwork is solid. I think this is as good as action artwork gets for this series. And I think that's really what saves this entire chapter, is that the action is actually really good.
Yes.
It's the typical high speed action that we get from Dragon Ball. And I think honestly for me, that's the only thing that saves this chapter from being worse than it is. Cause even the ending cap of like, oh, there's a paw print on the ground, and maybe that's a great ape or something. Cause
I was going to say,
Vegeta recognizes it. And even that, it's just like, that's not much of an ending. Cause it's like, okay, there's a paw print on the floor that might be a kaiju or something, or like a great ape or whatever. It doesn't excite you. It doesn't excite me at all.
When is the last time we saw a great ape?
Yeah.
It's been a while, hasn't it?
Yeah. It's been since, I think, the Saiyan saga.
Yeah. Since
Gohan transformation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
that's my guess, is I would assume that's what it is. I mean, we'll see, but
yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure if maybe, again, because we've seen with these, like Dragon Ball Super has been trying to integrate stuff from like more of the space setting that Dragon Ball GT had, but like making GT better, because it has made a lot of things that GT tried to do much better, because and that's how I feel like. And maybe we're going to start getting introduced more into the Saiyan mythology that like GT got into, because we saw the golden great ape or whatever. Yep. Maybe we're going to start seeing that be reintroduced, because obviously Granola keeps talking about the Saiyans and everything. So maybe this is going to be a Kira Toriyama's plan of like, let me actually dig into the Saiyans history more.
That's where I think he's going with it too. Honestly, I think Golden Great Ape, that's what came to my mind. Yeah. And because we're talking so much about the history of the Saiyans with Granola, it just kind of, I don't know. It just seems like where he's going to go, the direction he's going to go. And that would also, wouldn't it fit the trend of this being more of a filler arc too?
Yeah, and then because really the manga hasn't really dealt with that, because we saw that in the movie, in the Broly movie, of like we got to see more of the Saiyans history and all that stuff, because a lot of especially the beginning of the movie was took place before Dragon Ball was even started.
Yep.
With the Saiyans before their destruction. And maybe now this is where the manga is going to be like kind of digging into what the Broly movie did, of like showing us what the Saiyans before Frieza destroyed the planet Vegeta.
Yeah. So I think.
Yeah. So again, I don't really have much else to say, because this chapter was all just the action. Like there was that small bit of like I said, gas in being like, oh, we're dastardly villains talking, but even that was just to me, just overall this chapter was it is what it is. It's a necessary action to get Granola's power level over to be matched Goku and Vegeta, but even then I feel like it's not as successful as it could have been. But again, that's all just based on just the setup for this entire arc has just been a big miss.
Agreed.
And so, all right, but how would you grade the chapter 72 of Dragon Ball Super?
Gosh, I mean, wow. If there were some compelling villains, I might feel different, but Oil, Mackie, and Alec and Gas are just such snoozes. And story, honestly, Kevin, man, I'm going to go 4 Night Girls out of 10 for the story. I hate to do that because I adored the Dragon Ball franchise like few other franchises, but golly, just the villains suck.
Yep.
And the buildup has been terrible, and it's just not much to this at all. So yeah. 4 Night Girls out of 10 for the story. The art's nice. I'm going to go 8 Night Girls out of 10 for the art.
Yeah, I think for me, it's the story. I'll go a little bit lower than you, just because again, I just really don't, I'm not enjoying the story whatsoever, especially coming off the high of the Moro saga. Mm-hmm. It's like, this just is not living up to what we've seen from Dragon Ball Super. And you, for all the complaints about the power, like the power levels and the, that we may have, but it's still been fun. Like I would say Dragon Ball Super has been fun up to this
point. Yeah.
And this is just not fun. It's not just fun. It's just feels boring for boring's sake. So I would actually honestly grade this chapter 3 Night Girls out of 10. Because again, I think this is very much driven by the art.
Yeah.
And having the action. And I think this is what you would expect from a shonen manga. So even though there's not a lot of character work, so I would still grade it maybe like a 7 Night Girls out of 10, because again, it's very good. It's what I would expect from a shonen manga, but it's not like exceptional like we've seen in like Kaiju number 8 or the Spy X Family. So overall, that's a 5 Night Girls out of 10 for this chapter. So all right, well, going from there, I wanted to talk about the newest manga that was released this past month by the creator of Tokyo Ghoul, Tsuishida. So he released a manga called Shoujin X, the first chapter released this month. And this month's chapter, for the introduction, we see that there's, we start out with a passenger plane, this young girl and grandmother kind of bonding over something, but then all of a sudden there's this supernatural person that attacks it and sets the entire plane ablaze. And over at a school, a kid named Tokio Kurohara notices the plane on fire, tries to tell his teacher about it, but his teacher tells him, hey, pay attention in class, we're still in class. So showing that she doesn't really care about that there's a plane on fire in the sky. And then after school, Tokio notices a woman being hounded by some thugs, and then he decides to do something about it by calling his childhood friend named Azuma Higashi to help out. Azuma easily takes care of these thugs that were hounding this woman, saving her in the process. And then we learn that both Tokio and Azuma, they want to do something about this whole crisis going on with these things called Chojin, who are humans with supernatural powers from unknown origins. And Azuma especially, he wants to help out with this crisis because we see that, like, from him taking on these thugs, that he is an exceptional fighter. And obviously Tokio is all for it. He wants, because again, it's his childhood friend, he wants to back him up. And Tokio is so enamored by his friend, we see that he even talks up Azuma to his family, like with his sister, his mom and dad and everything. And they even call him out of, like, you're a little obsessed with Azuma. As that is going on, we see this mysterious person approach three guys with an offer to give them superpowers with this syringe that this person has. So we don't really know if they take him up on this offer, but this offer is made. So the next day we see Tokio, he convinces Azuma to skip school so that they could go help out with the cleaning efforts at the plane, where we learn during the plane crash, even though that the plane was engulfed in flames, about 200 people survived the plane crash mysteriously. And as they are talking about the plane crash and helping out with cleaning, they end up being attacked by this Chojin, who has flexible powers. Basically, he could turn his body kind of like almost like Mr. Fantastic, rubber style. And his name is Johnny Kiyoshi Takayama. Attacks Azuma and everybody, and is able to knock him out. And then he offers three other thugs a chance to become Chojins. And seeing all this, Tokio sees that Azuma is knocked out. He grabs his friend, tries to get him to safety because, again, they are no match for this Chojin. But as they make a run for it, Azuma sees that there's a syringe on the floor. He says, hey, we need to save people. This is our chance. To be what we talked about the other day. Tokio remembers that, and they decide, hey, you know what? We're going to do this together. They inject themselves with the syringe. They both transform into Chojin. And next we see is that Tokio, who becomes a bestial Chojin, and he has this kind of almost medicine man from, we would see from the Renaissance kind of costume with the mask and everything. That's what he kind of transforms into, and he's a bestial Chojin, and he attacks Johnny, and that's kind of where we end this chapter of Chojin X. What do you think of this introduction for Tsuishida's newest manga creation?
Kevin, look, I wanted to love this manga. I really did. I wanted to love it, and I think I'm going to take blame myself. Part of the blame is on me. Okay, I'll own it. It's fine. When I see the word Chojin, I think Kinnikuman. Okay, that's the only manga I have ever seen, Kevin, use that word. I've never seen another manga use it. It's only been Kinnikuman, because Chojin means basically Superman, is what it means. And so everyone in Kinnikuman, you're either a good Chojin or an evil Chojin or a god Chojin, but that's what they all are, right? And so, in my head, I have, okay, superhero, right? And then what we get with Chojin X is really more of a horror slash dark fantasy manga versus a superhero one. So initially I was like, whoa, whoa. It's kind of like, you know, Kevin, when I was a little kid, my mom bought a bunch of muffins, right? And I thought they were chocolate chip. And I thought they were blueberry muffins. They're really chocolate chip, which is delicious, right? But I thought they were blueberry and I ate into it. And I was like, oh my God, oh, this is horrible. This is the worst chocolate chip muffin I ever had in my life. No. It's because it was. You know, when you think something is blueberry and it's instead chocolate chip, you don't like the taste of it, right? So I'm expecting one thing. I got something totally different, which is fine. I am in general not a, the horror genre does nothing for me. I just find it very boring. I don't like it. It's boring. Mm-hmm. I've never liked it. There's nothing about it I enjoy. The dark fantasy genre, hit or miss with me. Hit or miss. So with this, it simply, I think if you like the horror genre, if you like the dark fantasy genre, you will be far more interested in this world than me.
Yeah.
The idea is interesting. Don't get me wrong. It is very interesting. The writing is solid. They've certainly, you get swerved in the beginning of the manga because Ishida sets it up with the little girl in the airplane and you're like, oh, how nice. You know, typical shonen style manga, this little girl, she's precocious and whatever, whatever. And then she's dead.
Yeah.
Burnt to a crisp. She's dead. So you're like, whoa, okay. Didn't see that coming. And the two characters, the two main characters to this manga, you've got Tokyo and then you've got Azuma. And it kind of reminds me, did you ever read or watch Black Clover?
I've watched a couple episodes.
Okay. You know how like the main character is kind of like the loser?
Mm-hmm.
Loser's a little harsh, but not as successful as his best friend who's more of successful.
The prodigy.
Right? Yeah, right. And so there's that kind of relationship. We kind of have that here with Tokyo kind of being the wannabe while Azuma is the man. And I don't know, Kevin, the relationship between those two characters doesn't really work for me because it's not, I've never seen that growing up. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of, I don't know. It's just,
yeah.
I don't know. It just didn't work for me. I guess it's something I couldn't really relate to maybe. And it could just be me and how I was brought up. I don't know, Kevin. It's not a relationship I saw really.
Yeah. And I think this series, cause I'm in agreement. I didn't connect with this chapter very much, this intro chapter. And I think it's mostly just because this series is coming in like off the heels of like the success of My Hero Academia.
Yes.
And other series that have been dealing with like the super, like more superhero and more superpower,
yes,
characters. In general, we've seen like, especially in manga, we've seen much more of an influence of like the comic books coming into manga a lot more, like, yes, in the last couple of years of like, everybody's having like a lot more people are having superpowers. It's not just,
yes,
like where manga usually is tended to be like supernatural or energy based powers and stuff like,
right,
that. Now we're starting to see people, oh yeah, there's people born with these special abilities and things like that. So we've seen a lot more of that. And I think Chojin X is a little bit late on for this game, whereas is she just trying to tell his own version of it? It feels like almost like,
yes,
with this, and all the superpower stuff and the way it's told. Cause I would say this isn't even a horror. This is just purely dark fantasy. Cause there wasn't really anything scary about it. Kind of like with
Tokyo and stuff. Yeah.
I think you get that more from the artwork because it's very creepy vibe. Even like the main characters,
super creepy, right?
Their designs even are more like what you would see from a horror manga like that. But this is not. This is more just, I would say, just dark fantasy. I think it's the design aspect of it. Like even with the rubber guy, like that has like that Mr. Yes. Fantastic style powers. He's very drawn. Like, oh, this is very, very creepy. I'm like, oh, I like chill down my spine. But at the same time, it's not. Because like this is supposed to be a scary manga, it's more so, oh, there's some creepy elements that I would associate with dark fantasy, like when I watch something like one of those dark fantasy movies, it just came to my head, but I forgot the movie. So I would say that's what this is. And even the main characters themselves, I think they're very generic, it feels, yes, like there's, yes, this, like you said, there's this prodigy. And then there's also this guy that's his best friend that kind of looks up to him, and they have a very good relationship. I do like that. It's a very positive relationship. It's, yes, not that like the one thing I will give credit for is that Azuma and Tokyo obviously like each other. That it's not, it's not like a Bakugo or Deku thing of like Bakugo just like Deku's just hanging on to Bakugo and stuff like that. It's not that type of relationship at all. It's they're very much best friends. They've been friends from childhood and stuff like that. So and you could see that from the dialogue and everything that they do like and support each other. They're not, it's not like it's not, yeah. So I, like I said, it's not like Bakugo or Deku or like Sasuke Naruto type thing of like, they're we are supposed to believe they're friends because they're the two main characters. It's it's not that, or that they're the first characters that we're introduced to.
Yeah.
But it's more, yeah, you know what? They are, they've been friends for a while. They support each other and all that. So, and I think that that's the strength of this.
Did they seem right? Didn't their interactions just seem weird to you though? A little bit. Like it just,
It felt forced. A lot of it felt
Maybe that's it. Boring, forced. Maybe forced is a better word for how it felt. It did. It just didn't feel organic.
Yeah. Or
particularly interesting and unique.
Yeah, it didn't. I would say it's just that it just didn't feel like what we're used to of like, because we're so used to, like, especially the two main characters that come up, like, usually are antagonistic towards each other, like in most shonen, where this, like, they're starting out already as friends. And we don't normally see that, especially with these like things that deal with superpowers and the two main rivals. Like, they're not, it doesn't feel like they're rivals. Like, I think that's the big thing, is that they're not rivals. They're more just friends. They're just friends. Yeah. And I think that, I think that maybe the thing that's throwing off is that usually we're so accustomed to rivals like Goku Vegeta, Bakugo Deku, Naruto Sasuke.
So
that's not what this is. It's a very different way of starting, which I do like that. That's the one thing that's different, but I think it's everything else about this world that just doesn't feel like it's unique or doesn't it doesn't have that hook. It doesn't have the hook of like, I want to know more. I may try and read the second chapter, but this first chapter doesn't make me want to get invested in this world like other manga that we've been introduced to, like with Candy Flurry that we were introduced to recently, or Blue Box and stuff like that, where I do want to know a little bit more. I want to read the next chapter. You got me enough invested. This one just doesn't connect with me.
It doesn't rope you in. It doesn't pull you in. It doesn't get you deeply immersed in the story. And it doesn't have that unique, interesting hook that just grabs you and it makes you go, I got to come back for the next installment of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think the one thing I did like about this, and that Ishida did do a little bit different, is that we don't really see this in manga at all. And I can't remember the last time we had it. It's where we had a spread page that wasn't just two pages. It was like three or four pages, I think. Yeah, and that was like a thing that was like, we see this in comic books every once in a while, like once a year, we'll see this like with a specific artist, but I've never seen that in a manga. Where like artists will do more than a spread page that's more than two pages long. And I was like, that was the thing. I think the thing that stood out most and made like Tokyo's reveal of like his Renaissance doctor appearance stand out even more was that was that like special spread page. I think it was like about two pages, like three pages long. With the stretched arm and stuff. So I did enjoy that. It's like a little bit different than what we would normally see. So I do commend Ishida for doing that. And I think in general, the artwork is what the strength is of this. Like the designs for Tokyo and Ishida isn't as strong. But when it gets down to actually showing the superpowers, I think that's when the artwork is very good. Like Tokyo's Chojin look is, I think, very, very cool. Like has a very cool, like I could see cosplayers cosplaying as that. And then like the guy with that stretches his body, like the way he stretches his neck is very, like I said, it's very creepy and things like that. So he does, like, again, like you said, it attaches kind of those horror elements a little bit, but in a dark fantasy world.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with you on that. The art is, I mean, don't get me wrong. The art is well done. And there's no doubt that Ishida is talented. It is not particularly the style of art that I seek out, but it is well done, and I can appreciate the difference between the two. The look of the bestial Chojin at the end, he has kind of like that Hieronymus Bosch design a skull design to his head.
Yeah, and I think that's where it shines most. And it kind of reminds me even like comic book art, where like when we see like artists specifically, they're much better, more suited to drawing the action side of things and the like the superhero aspect of this series than they are with like maybe the regular people side of things.
Yes.
And that's what this manga reminds me of a lot, is like he struggles a little bit with how to draw the characters when they're not wearing masks or totally like, in their superhero like their costumes, or when they're doing something like supernatural, like the stretch guy or the flexi shoujin. And so I think that's where he struggles a bit. And I just don't enjoy that style when it comes to just for him drawing humans characters.
Right. And I think that's why Tokyo and Azuma look kind of generic.
Yeah.
That's not his strength. That's not his artistic strength. That's why I think they just come across as kind of a boring looking characters. Yeah. It's just not that interesting looking. And it doesn't really, I mean, honestly, I was going through this chapter going, this art isn't that good, not that interesting. Whoa, holy cow, look at this art when you get to the, you know, final page shoujin and and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, oh, well, this is a totally different ball game now. Yeah. So you can tell where, you know, his style of art really, Ishida really shines more with the supernatural stuff than he does with just the slice of life stuff, you know.
Okay, cool. Yeah, is there anything else that you wanted to mention before we get to our ratings?
I feel like if you like dark fantasy, you might want to give it a try. It's just honestly, Kevin, even for that, the chapter felt so bland to me. Mm-hmm. that there's so many manga titles out there that you really have to come out the box hot, and you have to show the reader why you're different. Like, let's go to the Candy Flurry manga that we tried in the last podcast. That came out the box and said, look how unique we are. Boom. That was really cool. They got across in no time flat how unique it is, how interesting this world is, how different it is, and why you need to come back for the second chapter, because only I'm going to give you what I got here. You're not going to find this in another title. Whereas with Chojin X, I don't feel like that was done.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and overall, what would you rate this chapter, this opening chapter?
I will go... the writing, I will give it 4 night girls out of 10. The art, I'll go 6 night girls out of 10 for a total of 5 night girls out of 10.
Okay, yeah, I'm not too different from you. I think the writing and story in general, it was fine. It is what it is. It's very much what I would expect from a generic manga series. It doesn't hook me. I think the biggest thing is that it didn't hook me for to read more. So I would rate the story like 5 night girls out of 10. And the artwork, again, I think its strength is when it comes to the supernatural part of it, of the story. Not so much the slice of life, just a character-centric drawing to humans. But again, it's solid overall. So I would give it a 6 night girls out of 10. So 5.5 night girls out of 10 for overall. Again, I think we're both in agreement of like, it is what it is. It's if you're into just dark fantasy, you want to give it a try, sure. But again, it just didn't hook me as a non-fan of that, of this style of a manga. So. All right, awesome. Well, I think that's really where we're going to close out the this episode. So again, thank you again, Rock, for joining me on this episode. Where can we find you online if people wanted to like follow you on like social media and stuff?
Yeah, you can check me out on Twitter at Rock with 2K's Revolution, on Instagram also Rock with 2K's Revolution, and of course you can check me out, I'm over at comicbookrevolution.com. Not with the frequency of you, Kevin. Of course, nobody's going to touch you. And also the Comic Revolution podcast. You can check that out on all podcast services anywhere and everywhere.
Awesome. Well, all right. And you could find me on Twitter and Instagram at KevinL007 and TikTok at NerdyKev. Like Rock said, I'm do a lot of stuff on comicbookrevolution.com. I just did a piece on like the 10 characters to watch for in the future of My Hero Academia. So check that out, of like characters that haven't appeared yet in the current story arc for My Hero Academia that I believe are set up to be very big characters in the future of the series. So go check that out along with all our other reviews for manga and comic books. And you can find our Manga Revolution podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and everywhere you could get download podcasts. If we're not somewhere, just let me know and we'll make sure that that you can find us and always rate and review us 5 stars on all those platforms. And again, thank you very much for joining me on this episode of Rock, and I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Thanks, Kevin.